Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of January 17th, 2016. I almost went back a year. Wow. Anyway, today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, Mr. D.R. Tucker?
Good. How are you doing?
Great to have you here, as always. So, D.R., some of the stuff that's floating around this week... One of the big things that's floating around this week is the fact that stock market is having a semi-correction. Part of what's driving that is that the price of oil has collapsed. Part of the thing that's driving the price of oil to collapse is, of course, the slowdown in China. So the demand has dropped. But at the same time, there is an excess of fossil fuel on the market, right? Because of the fracking boom here in the United States.
Exactly.
And our friends in Saudi Arabia combating the fracking boom by pumping out as much gas as they want. And then the Iranians coming on market, pumping out gas as well. All of a sudden, so I saw an interesting art. So the whole question of what's going on in the oil industry and how it relates to climate change politics is one that is worth, you know, having a sense of, or at least having heard a few words about. So I saw this article by a guy named Anatole Kaletsky. Right? He's published it late last year. And he has this provocative idea that the oil companies should self-liquidate. That is to say, basically sell everything, give their money to the stockholders, and walk away. And his argument is more or less the following, that all of these big... ExxonMobil is in, and we saw last fall the Royal Dutch Shell spending billions of dollars to go explore in the Arctic, right? Desperately searching for new fossil fuels in the most esoteric and difficult circumstances, right?
And then they had to check out of the Chukchi Sea.
That's right, check out of the Chukchi. Anyway, with all this new oil coming online and the fact that there is the Paris Agreement and the whole world is moving away from fossil fuels, this guy's argument is that countries like Iran, which claims it can produce oil for $1 a barrel, right, very cheaply because it's very accessible oil. It's not under the Arctic Sea. It's right there under that. I mean, the oil companies cannot compete anymore. Right? Yep. They should not be looking for new fossil fuels. In fact, what they ought to be doing is taking all their money, selling off all the resources that they have, and liquidating themselves, giving that money to the shareholders, and essentially do what some of the tobacco companies did, right? Self-liquidate. And I just think it's a fascinating idea. Not so much that Roy Tillerson at Exxon is ever going to do that, but the idea that someone's talking, I guess it's the Overton window, right? It's one of the acceptable things to talk about. And all of a sudden you say, oh, you know, the oil companies ought to just go self-liquidate. When that becomes a legitimate thing to say, that's progress, right?
Exactly. Talk about moving beyond petroleum.
Yeah, beyond petroleum. Well, and I think you and I have said on this show before that if Exxon and Shell and Royal Dutch Shell and those companies took all that engineering resource and money and aimed it at renewable energies, I mean, they would dominate the world energy market.
Exactly. That was the point. That's the point Bill McKibben made after the revelations about Exxon knowing since 1977 about the reality of human-caused climate change, that they could have taken all their resources and basically dominated the clean energy market. They could have been Elon Musk before Elon Musk.
And they still, I think they still could be, although, I mean, now the cat's kind of out of the bag, but, I mean, there is a huge amount of intellectual capital in those companies, and if they pointed in the right direction, I mean, the thing that, you know, somebody said to me many years ago is kind of trite, but... You know, the reason the railroad industry collapsed was because all the railroad guys thought they were railroad people, and they didn't know they were in the transportation industry, right? So when trucks come along and they're cheaper, all of a sudden there's no need for the railroads and they die. And these
big
companies think they're in the oil business when they should be in the energy business, which are very distinctly different things, aren't they?
Exactly. And as Neela Banerjee, I think, pointed out at Inside Climate News, back in the during the late 1970s oil crisis, Exxon figured, you know, we should be in the energy business, not necessarily the fossil fuel business per se, but there was a philosophical change, you know, 7 or 8 years later, and that's when they went to all in on denial and all in on drill, baby, drill.
Well, so, I mean, this idea of self-liquidation is kind of the backdrop for some of the other things that happened this week. One is that a company called Arch Coal, which is an enormous coal company, filed for bankruptcy, right?
Yep.
And I see you smiling, D.R. Yes, Arch Coal filing, and God hope Peabody's right behind him, right? But Arch Coal, they were the people that were trying to, fully expected to be carrying coal to the ports in Seattle for shipment over to China, right?
Yep.
And now China has said they're not going to build any more coal power plants, right? Mm-hmm. And price of oil, everything's collapsed. Arch is trying to stay alive. They didn't want to go into bankruptcy. Of course, they'll still exist after the bankruptcy, but they'll be owned by their investors in a much different way. And so, yep. I mean, that's just a bellwether, as they say, just a piece of information.
Mm-hmm. And all the people who kept on talking about, you know, a clean coal, it's like coal's getting its clock cleaned, basically.
Well, the other thing that I'm fascinated with, although I have no shred of data to support this, except the guy who made a comment on the BBC that I heard, but there's a company called Saudi Aramco, right? And Aramco stands for Arab American Oil Company, right? And that was Aramco was the big company in the 50s after the Second World War, and then the Saudis nationalized it and became Saudi Aramco. It's a sovereign state-owned oil company in Saudi Arabia. In fact, I think it's like the big one. They have announced they're thinking about having an initial public offering of stocks to own. So it's like, wow. What if we could get Bill McKibben to buy stock in Saudi Aramco and he could go to the shareholder meetings and ask them what their carbon plan is?
And as you know, that's happened with Exxon, where some of the Exxon stockholders who want Exxon to get out of fossil fuels and go to clean energy, they've repeatedly shown up at Exxon's stockholder meetings and pressured Rex Tillerson, the CEO of Exxon, you know, what are you going to do? And Rex Tillerson keeps pushing back and pushing back and pushing back, but they're consistent, they're dogged and determined to basically say, hey, you know, we're stockholders here, we want Exxon to be a sustainable company, and we're going to use whatever power we have to sort of push you in a direction of sustainability.
Well, I mean, I have not seen much reportage on the Saudi Aramco IPO after the initial thing, but there was one guy on the radio saying that maybe they're going to take that money and put it into solar power. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, they have, you know, the Sinai Peninsula, not the Sinai Peninsula, but that whole, you know, all of Saudi Arabia is open desert. You could build lots of solar panels there. And they and I think, you know, the Saudi family may have more coherence about what the future's bringing, right? And so in 150 years, they want to have the desert covered with oil, with solar panels. Who knows?
You have to ask yourself, would they have done that without that Paris Climate Agreement?
Exactly. I mean, I think that the Paris Agreement, where the world essentially said, you know, in 50 to 75 years, we're not going to use any more oil, that's the proverbial biblical handwriting on the wall, right?
Exactly.
You look at that and say, okay, I have to take that to heart. And so there's all that stuff floating around. And I guess there are two other things going on here in the United States which may or may not affect things. Well, actually, there's always many things, right? Who knows if the Porter Ranch methane leak, the ongoing disaster there, has any consequence for the oil company's stocks.
Mm-hmm.
But the president talked about, gave his State of the Union, and there were some articles about how there may already be legal authority in the EPA to take action on much stronger action on climate than there was before. So, I mean, first, let's talk a little bit about what the president said in the State of the Union. So he gave a short statement, which I don't have in front of me now. But basically, well, what did he say, DR?
He said in essence that we must take more responsibility in terms of the leasing of dirty energy on public lands. He said specifically, quote, "We've got to accelerate the transition away from dirty energy rather than subsidize the past. We should invest in the future, especially in communities that rely on fossil fuels. That's where we're going to push to change the way we manage our oil and coal resources so that they better reflect the costs they impose on taxpayers and our planet. That way we put money back into those communities and put tens of thousands of Americans to work building a 21st century transportation system." So the speculation is that you're going to increase the fees that developers have to pay to sort of gain access to fossil fuels and public lands, and use that revenue to sort of push to accelerate the transition towards clean energy, sort of like a version of a carbon pricing system.
Right, and so there's, to unpack the president's statement, one thing you just touched on is, leasing cost to dig coal out of federal land should go up. And the cost that should be imposed is what's called the social cost of carbon, right? And I think we've talked about this in the show in the past, but it's basically an estimate of how much damage is a pound of carbon dioxide going to do. And it's like $17 or $20 of damage, right? That is the basis on which you set the leasing fees for to take coal out of public land. At least that's what the president is hinting at, right?
Exactly. And David Roberts of Vox mentions that the collected fees apparently make reference to a Power Plus plan, a proposal that would funnel millions of dollars into struggling coal mining communities, and also there's a discussion of an energy security trust, something that Obama mentioned in the 2013 State of the Union, which would have put $2 billion towards research into clean energy and to, as David Roberts points out, decarbonizing the U.S. transportation sector. So in other words, this whole idea is to essentially take revenues collected from those who want to exploit public lands for the fossil fuels on the lands, and then try to accelerate the country's transition towards clean energy, trying to turn a negative into a positive, basically.
And I think that we, again, all of this stuff is continuing, but it's interesting to see how it interplays. It was several weeks ago, I think, DR, you mentioned that two senators, Bernie Sanders being one, and the guy from the West Coast,
Jeff Merkley,
had made a proposal explicitly to call for increased costs of extracting fossil fuels from federal lands. And the president and climate hawks have been talking about this now lately, and the president's responded, right? It's in the State of the Union. I mean, it's sort of this oblique hint, but there's a little bit of talk about doing something more aggressive in terms of managing our federal lands.
Exactly, and let's not also forget that great line where he said that when the Russians beat us into space, we didn't deny that Sputnik existed.
that was a beautiful one, right? That's right. So tell me, DR, the other potential thing that spells bad news for the oil companies and good news for most of humanity has something to do with the Clean Air Act, right? Explain what you were looking at.
There are two reports, one from Kara Horowitz on Legal Planet and one from Jill Rome on Climate Progress, basically discussing a new legal analysis by several legal scholars, in which it says that there is a provision in the Clean Air Act, Section 115 of the Clean Air Act, that essentially would allow the EPA to implement or to push for the implementation of state-level cap and trade programs or carbon tax programs. Even Joe Rome notes that the international air pollution provision of the Clean Air Act.
Excuse me, DR. The Section 115 is called what? The International Air Pollution?
It's called the International Air Pollution Act, and according to Kara Horowitz, the provision authorizes the EPA to require states to address emissions that contribute to air pollution in danger of public health or welfare in other countries. Now, the Supreme Court obviously ruled in 2007 that CO2 is in fact an air pollutant that endangers public health or welfare. So under Section 115, the EPA would have, according to Kara Horowitz, broad latitude to address international air pollution through the Clean Air Act's state implementation plan process, and that would allow a community-wide cross-sectoral greenhouse gas emissions trading program that incorporates both stationary and mobile sources. So in other words, that the EPA, under this interpretation of the Clean Air Act, already has the authority to induce states to implement state cap and trade policies, much like California's AB 32, or state carbon taxes, much like what is being proposed in Washington State. So it's
Interesting.
interesting that Horowitz specifically says that, you know, this would be, without further congressional action, the sort of economy-wide cap on emissions that's been elusive ever since the Waxman-Markey bills collapsed in 2009 and 2010, and states would have flexibility, and this could exist in concert with the Clean Power Plan, because the
Right.
Clean Power Plan covers specifically emissions from power plants. This would cover economy-wide emissions.
And
So,
this thing has been has sort of come up because the Paris Agreement is now this internet is a more international level recognition of international harm.
yes, and they Joe Rome knows that this is specifically triggered by the Paris Climate Agreement, that this sort of invokes the what is being pointed as the international effect of you know, United States emissions. So as a result of that, according to Joe Rome, you know the administration, and potentially any future administration that would like to do this, they have the chance to go ahead now. They don't need any further congressional action from Congress. In essence, the Clean Air Act is already carbon pricing legislation, which is a phenomenal development, and definitely has implications for the upcoming elections, because obviously it's going to trigger a discussion as to, you know, will the next president have an EPA that is going to go further than even Gina McCarthy has in terms of trying to combat carbon pollution.
I think it's interesting that this law written in 1971 and rewritten in 1991 or so has within it the seeds of action on things that they never anticipated. I mean, it tells you do the right thing in the present and the future will take care of itself.
Well, there's another interesting angle of this, and this is just something I just thought of it and didn't come up in either the Horowitz or the Rome pieces. If you read Al Gore's book Earth and the Balance, he talks about the 1990 Clean Air Act and how it was, you know, used to sort of combat acid rain. He says that at the time there was a push by some legislators to try to have CO2 included in the 1990 Clean Air Act, but it was vetoed by other, but it was rejected by other legislators, presumably from fossil fuel producing parts of the country, who did not want that, and therefore it was taken out. And the 1990 Clean Air Act only facially included, you know, the sulfur dioxide. But it's very interesting that even though the 1990 Clean Air Act was technically blocked from addressing carbon pollution, there is this provision in the Clean Air Act that, in fact, allows the regulation of carbon pollution. So it's like they were too smart by half back then. And of course, it's been noted before that, in another great irony, that the 1990 Clean Air Act, among the various people who voted for that 1990 Clean Air Act, was then Congressman Jim Inhofe before he went to the Senate. So it's just
Before
fascinating on a number of different
he got his
levels.
Darth Vader mask on. All right, well,
Exactly.
DR, we got to leave it there. So let's tell our listeners that they can look up links to most of what we talk about at the blog. It's a sub page of the Mass Climate Action blog. It's massclimateaction.net/blog. Please visit us, leave a comment. You can find us on Facebook at /massclimateaction. You can listen to us on your smartphone using Stitcher or TuneIn Radio or any of a number of other podcast aggregators. You can find us on iTunes. Please subscribe. Pushes our numbers up. So we'll close to where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's a patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. So, DR, thank you for being here.
Thanks.
And thanks to everyone for listening. Have a great week. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.